and Susan Phillips. Thank you so much. Thanks for your support, dear friends. Stay tuned at 7 for Vegan World Radio. Thought for the week comes from Mother Teresa, who said, I used to pray that God would feed the hungry or do this or that, but now I pray that He'll guide me to do what I'm supposed to do, what I can do. I used to pray for answers. Now I'm praying for strength. I used to believe that prayer changes things, but now I know that prayer changes me and we change things. Take care of each other. Peace.
We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
Pacifica owned and listener supported for over 50 years. This is 90.1 KPFT and FM HD1 Houston.
When a Miami man brought home a live turkey for Thanksgiving, he didn't count on making a new friend. In the end, his family couldn't kill the friendly, curious young bird who gobbled back when spoken to. If you got to know a turkey, would you have the heart to hurt him? This Thanksgiving, give a bird a break by serving a vegan feast. Visit PETA.org for tasty free recipes.
Good evening and welcome to Vegan World Radio. This is Thanksgiving week, so later on this week, people will be getting together. You're listening to 90.1. This is KPFT in Houston, the Vegan World Radio show. I'll be one of your hosts for tonight. I'm Ocean.
And tonight we're honoring a bird that was honored by the ancient Mayans, Aztecs, Toltecs, referred to them as the jeweled birds, and that's the wild North American turkey.
So as you're gathering with your family this week, we ask you to have compassion in your heart for all of the animals and make sure to eat vegan, plan ahead. If you do gather with your family, we do have a recipe later for a pie recipe. You might want to come late and join them for dessert. That's one way to avoid the scary body parts on the table.
If you've been eating a low-violence diet, like, please stay strong. Don't go back to the animal killing, just because I know this, it's tempting to have all those delicious dishes with your family. But, you know, it's good for you, but it's obviously not good for the bird and not good for the other animals, the pigs, you know, the chickens, living horrendous conditions of suffering in confined animal production facilities. And I think it's significant that they do experience those conditions. They have experience. They're beings. They look with their eyes, they perceive with their minds, and they feel pain with their bodies, much the way that we do. And fundamentally, we don't need to eat meat for any reason. It's unhealthy anyway, and it's unkind to animals. So it may be inconvenient sometimes to say no to the food that people are offering you, and they may really put the pressure on you, or make fun of you, or all that kind of stuff. But you got to be able to just say, I say, you know, whatever, I love you guys, you're still my family, but I disagree on this, and stand strong, stand with the animals. It was famously said by George Bernard Shaw, animals are my friends, and I don't eat my friends.
There's a lot of amazing facts to learn about turkeys and pigs, about the actual animals. We're going to share a few tonight. Also, we're going to hear from Renee King Sonnen of the Rowdy Girl Animal Sanctuary here in Texas. And she helps you get to know a turkey personally and the reasons you would not want to cause one suffering or pay to have somebody else kill and hurt a turkey or a pig or any other animals. There's wonderful options. We're so lucky here in Houston. You can find many, many things from Whole Foods and other places to plan a vegan Thanksgiving meal or bring something along, or there's some all-you-can-eat vegan restaurants that are going to be open on the holiday, including Pine Forest Garden, a vegetarian restaurant out in Chinatown on Bel Air.
Buffet, right?
All-you-can-eat buffet. And I have friends in California, and they say, all you can eat, so you just can go as many times as you want. Not every city has that, so it's kind of a lucky thing.
Yeah, I can eat a lot.
All vegan. There's no cruelty on the menu. Also, Govinda's over on 34th Street by the Temple of the Hare Krishnas.
But they don't try to convert you or anything if you go there, right? It's not like.
But if you see a big, impressive architecture right next to the restaurant, that's their temple. But it is a separate restaurant on its own. And every Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday, I believe, they have an all-vegan menu.
Like, it's always vegetarian, right? But certain days, it's all vegan.
And especially on holidays, they have an all-vegan menu. And it is going to be Thanksgiving-oriented. So if you go to Pine Forest Garden, it's going to be Asian cuisine, which is excellent.
But if you want the actual, like the mashed potatoes, you
cranberries, mashed potatoes, gravy. I think they're going to have tofurkey this year. So it's worth checking out. But there's many options in Houston. So some of you guys already know those places. Other folks, you'd have a chance to Google stuff. But it's a great time if you have a friendly family, or as we put out a mention on another episode, you know, look out for your vegan relatives. Make it easier for them. Make it painless. Welcome them to, if you want to spend time with them. And there's ways to share. In fact, we have a fun fact.
Well, before we get to that, can we just close out like the fun facts about the turkeys?
Yes.
Like, did you know that wild turkeys can run between like 30 and 50 miles, like 55 miles per hour in the wild? One of the things we hear in the clip coming up with Renee up at a vegan animal sanctuary, Rowdy Girl Sanctuary, is that she actually like has a conversation with the turkey that's protected in her place, and it's neat to hear the turkey's voice, and the turkey like looks her in the eye and like speaks to her. And apparently turkeys have quite a few unique vocalizations, and they can be heard from quite a distance. Like they sort of call to each other. I guess they're turkeys are closely related to peacocks, right? The peacocks like famously kind of call to each other at a distance, right?
Benjamin Franklin greatly regarded the turkeys, also was a vegetarian for part of his life, that he chose as an ethical decision. Let's see, baby turkeys stay with their mothers for the first year of their lives in the wild, of course, as it should be. I mean, if they're not being tormented by humans, the skin that is sort of the signature, one of the signature aspects of the turkey, the skin that hangs over their beak, which is called the snoot, will change color, and their neck, the wattle, the skin, will change color, so they sort of have a mood ring effect on their skin, on their face.
Well, it's like people, sometimes some people, when they get real pissed off, like they turn like bright red, right? So like, we see an angry turkey coming at you with the bright red snoot and wattle, you better watch out.
They also can purr, and they can swim. They're really amazing, astonishing birds. So we're going to get ready to listen to Renee's experience with her turkey that she took in. But we also have a few facts about pigs, because some people unfortunately choose to eat pigs and or turkeys. And you don't have to do any of it. You don't have to eat anything from the animals to be healthy.
And it's particularly evil to eat pigs, because pigs are so close to us. And like, and the fact of proof of it is that they use pigs for animal testing. And if pigs are so much like us that they can be used for animal testing, then how can they turn around and say, no, but they're not like us, when you want to eat their bodies? Pigs, by like in terms of evolutionary treaty, like they split off like pretty close to us. And so like the studies have shown that they're capable of love and affection, and they have formed connections and bonds with each other and their family members. And pigs are very expressive, and pigs express fear, and they express sadness and sorrow. And people that have worked at animal sanctuaries report that pigs are very interested in people. They recognize individuals, of course. Pigs are very good at getting out of their pens, like figuring out how the mechanism on the pen works. In fact, the internet says that pigs are the fourth most intelligent animal on Earth, and they're smarter than dogs, and they're about equivalent to like a three-year-old human.
The mother pigs sing to their young while nursing. Pigs have a sophisticated sense of direction. They can find their way home from huge distances away. And you can find this infographic by Dr. Vegan. That's fun.
And they've been shown to dream and to have dreams. Because we watch our cats and dogs. We can see them asleep and you can see them moving their feet. And they're obviously like in the middle of a dream, or they'll talk in their sleep. So, you know, most mammals do that. And if you can have a dream, if you can imagine yourself in a place and imagine things happening to you, that shows that you have an understanding of experience, that you understand that your own existence and that you were living and that you were in the world. And the fact that animals top out at being similar to children, I think, doesn't mean that we have a right to be vicious to them and kill them and cut them up and eat their bodies. I really think it should go the other way. It shows that we should be protecting them. It shows that killing animals is a lot like killing children, because they are innocent creatures. They're innocent like children, innocent and vulnerable, and yet so alive and so individual. I can't understand. I don't understand why everyone isn't persuaded when they think about it. Like, oh, okay, you know, now I think about it. Yeah, we shouldn't kill these animals. I think I'm going to stop doing that. Like, why? I don't understand why it's so hard to persuade people. And I remember myself, there's a point when I thought about it and I knew in my heart that this was true, that animals have experiences. And I came to understand that it's not necessary for my health to eat them at all. Why was I so reluctant to stop eating it? I mean, there's so much, we're so good at like excusing our own behavior, and we're so good at helping each other excuse behavior that we know in our hearts is wrong. And our convenience weighs so heavily on us. It's so easy to just like here's some food. I just want to pick it up and eat it. You know, sometimes as a vegan, there's plenty of stuff to eat, but it's not always right there. It's not as convenient if you're just eating everything. There's going to be some situations where there's nothing for you to eat, some situations where the thing for you to eat isn't your favorite. But you can adjust to that. You can bring food with you. You figure out where to go. And at some point, if like everybody was vegan, then it would be super convenient, because all the food and all the grocery stores and all the restaurants would be vegan. And it's come a long ways. Vegans have gone from something like 1% of the population in the 90s to something like 5% of the American population that's vegetarian, and maybe 2% of those are vegan. So that means that there's a lot more vegan stuff in the grocery stores and whatnot. But sadly, it's slowing, and I think it's, our understanding is it's slowing from people that did stop eating animals and went back to eating animals. And I do want to put a call out to all of y'all that used to be vegetarian to come back to it, or at least whether or not you've ever been vegetarian, at least reduce the number of animals that you eat. At least eat animals a lot less often. Although the kindest thing is to just cut it out entirely. The kindest thing is to draw a line and say it is immoral to cut the throat of an animal and then tear the muscle from its bone and then eat it. You don't need to do that. We don't need to do that. I personally haven't eaten meat since 1994, I think, 1994. So that's something like, I'm like 30 years in on not eating meat, and I haven't eaten any dairy products since 1998, I think. You know what? You're not going to get any cholesterol. People take all these pills to reduce their cholesterol because at some point they realize the cholesterol is just gumming up their insides, especially your arteries. Why take pills to reduce your cholesterol? Hey, how about you just don't eat cholesterol? Your body's still going to make the good cholesterol. Just stop eating cholesterol. Cholesterol only comes from animals. So it's good for you, and it's good for the animals, and it's good for the planet too, because it's environmentally destructive to raise all this feed crop, feed corn, alfalfa, feed soybeans, and then feed those to animals, raise them until they're large, and then eat their bodies. Particularly for cattle and pigs, if you look at how much carbon dioxide is put in the atmosphere to create food from pigs and cows' bodies, it's enormous. It's absolutely enormous. It's the most destructive way to eat. So all kinds of reasons not to eat animals on this Thanksgiving. And we're going to hear in a minute, Renee's going to talk about a practice they do at animal sanctuaries where instead of eating a turkey, they actually gather around a turkey and they feed the turkey. Like, they celebrate the turkey, like honor the turkey. What an amazing reversal that could be.
You're going to listen to this next. You can find it on YouTube It's entitled Walking Our House Turkey, and you can look at Renee's sanctuary page, rowdygirlsanctuary.org, I think it is. And she's really put Texas on the map. She's been in a number of movies. She's, you know, there's a lot of haters that try to bring her down, but I can't help but wonder if they're maybe funded by the cattle industry that wants to not have a vegan animal sanctuary here in Texas. But she's made a tremendous difference by offering refuge to people that want to find a safe home for their 4-H animal when they've lost the nerve to betray them. So Renee really is doing good work, her and her husband Tommy. And I believe they have their 2025 wall calendar coming out. So there's some cool things to check out on their page. But let's listen to that next and hear about the story of Seeley.
One of the most curious aspects of getting to know a turkey is their body language and the sounds they make. Come on, Seeley. I have to gently nudge her because one of the things we must do is forage. Come on, let's go outside. But she looks up. She just keep going. She's wanting to go. Open the door and going outside. Seeley was raised by a family in Seeley, Texas. She's almost 9. The lady that took care of Seeley her whole life thought she was a baby chicken. She bought a bunch of chicks, brought them all home, and lo and behold, as the weeks and the months flew by, Seeley became a turkey. She fell in love with Seeley. This lady kept Seeley in her backyard for 8 years. She lived in the backyard. She had a habitat there. She had a place where she roosted every night. And Seeley lived outside in the backyard in Seeley, Texas for 8 years until one day a new neighbor moved in, and they could not stand Seeley. They wanted to kill her because Seeley would fly over the fence and play with her toddlers. Well, if Seeley wants to play with the toddler and flap her wings, she could scare the poo-poo out of one of them. So that happened a few times. And so this family that moved in portrayed Seeley as this monster almost, and they were going to kill her if she came back over their yard one more time and scared her kids. We need to have a relationship with other species outside of ourselves and quit seeing them as different. A dog, a cat, a rhinoceros, an elephant, a human, a turkey. We all have somebody looking out of the eyes and into the soul. She's going to get a dust bath in. That's a good place for a dust bath, Seeley. Every single being on this planet looks out of their eyes, and if you happen to catch the look in somebody's eye and they're suffering, you can feel the suffering through their eyes. You can actually taste the exchange of the violence and the fear that they're experiencing. You have to know that there's somebody looking back. You know, and that somebody looking back is what's on your plate if you're eating the tortured body parts of other individuals. So this is something I'm reading out of Time magazine. Turkey is the centerpiece of most Thanksgiving meals, a time when family, friends, and loved ones come together for an expansive and filling meal. But Thanksgiving marks a far darker time in the short farm-bred lives of these gobbling poultry. Around 45 million turkeys will be killed this year as a result of high demand for the annual feast, according to the National Turkey Federation. Bred into existence for one reason, taste, and because you buy it. You buy the suffering. You are chewing on the body part of an individual that was tortured, that was made to watch his friends and his family die before him. You are chewing on the body of someone that wanted to live like Seeley. See, these messages of violence towards animals are being hidden from you. And I know you're better than that. I know everybody listening that loves animals would never deliberately do that. You have actually rejected your own moral compass in exchange for a system that's broke. Y'all, it's time to wake up. This is Celie. It's her life. She deserves a life well lived. She can jump up. Come on, Celie. That's good. Okay, just keep on coming. Keep on coming all the way back. There she is. There's Queen Celie. Okay, let's shut the door. The other turkeys that really hold special memories for me that started all this, the first one was Cooper. Our very first Thanksgiving, instead of, you know, going to a family member's house and feasting on turkey, we took the feast to the turkey. And boy, what a feast it was. And there was something about this celebration that really anchored the fact that, you know, turkeys deserve to be with us at Thanksgiving, not in us. And Chi-Chi and Alana, these awesome turkeys that came to Rowdy Girl the next year, they only lived a little over a year because they were programmed to get so obese that their system shut down on them so quickly. But these babies were so loving. Alana particularly had the disposition of a child that when you went into her enclosure and you stooped down, she would run to you and hug you. She would nuzzle right up into your neck. Let's all work together to create the best life possible for each individual on this planet. Thank you.
So this is the Vegan World Radio Show on 90.1 KPFT in Houston, and we were just listening to a video from Renee King Sonnen of the Rowdy Girl Farm Animal Sanctuary.
That's located in Texas, right?
Yeah, west of Houston, between Houston and Austin, and she does a lot of great work. And also remember that pigs also are victimized a lot and consumed during Thanksgiving. So we also want to point your attention to Esther the Wonder Pig. She has an amazing story. She was, and it was a similar story to Celie. She was taken in, they thought, as a micro pig. And then when they realized she was growing into a full-size farm pig, her whole family went vegan. They actually created an animal sanctuary. They made a lot of books about her. So it just, it's such a positive thing.
They worked with veterinarians to develop some animal veterinarian science for pigs because, well, apparently, very few people have ever tried to actually heal pigs and care for them because, you know, usually they just kill them before they get too old. Especially the grotesque way that the farm animals, farm pigs, have been genetically manipulated, that they had some challenges in her old age. That's an interesting part of that story, too, I think.
Also, if you get interested in any of this, we recommend allcreatures.org. So it's all-creatures.org. They have a huge amount of material and poetry and news stories and inspiring things and for every topic, including Thanksgiving. So we'd recommend that as well. So there's a lot to explore for Thanksgiving, and we're coming up on our two-minute recipe. This week we're going to feature a pie because, as we discussed earlier, sometimes dessert is the time to show up for Thanksgiving. So we have a coconut cream vegan pie, Gretchen's Vegan Bakery. But before we get to that, we just had a quick sample. This is from the old Tom Snyder show. And he's, of course, passed away, as have almost all of the original cast members from Gilligan's Island. But it is sort of considering Thanksgiving's coming up. If you're lucky enough to have family to get together with, it's a way to avoid talking about politics and remember some fond feelings of the old TV show that was just silly, but also just had an endearing effect. And all of, like I said, almost all but one of the original cast members have passed away. But this is three that he briefly spoke to. And the actress who played Marianne was famous for her coconut cream pies, and she mentions it a little bit in her cookbooks. We had to show an authentically vegan recipe. But the fun fact is that Gilligan, the actor who played Gilligan,
Bob Denver,
is mentioned to be a vegetarian, which I never knew.
I didn't know that. Bob Denver is a vegetarian, huh? Well, I guess a lot of those like 1950s kind of beatnik guys were vegetarian, right?
Yeah, so I thought that's a fun little piece of trivia to know and to just hear their voices. And all three of those existing cast members had come up with a little book. But all of these characters became so well-known from that show that they became sort of a family to each other over the years, as well as to all of us. And so keep that in mind when you're with your own family. People come to us differently, but we've got to try to get along.
You're right. You got to be nice with your family and your friends. Don't make the strong points, even though the strong points are actually true and correct, but and are very, very provable. But it doesn't always make you popular.
So you're going to be listening to that next from the old Tom Snyder show. Right before that, because it's a short clip, and then we're going to go to the short two-minute recipe to give you an idea for an easy pie. Actually, this YouTuber, she doesn't make the crust, and she gets also some pre-made vegan whipped cream, but she tells you how to make that coconut custard. And again, go to her website to find out the real, look at the actual Gretchen's Vegan Bakery to get the proper recipe. This is to just give you an idea to get in the kitchen and start cooking. But before we get to that or the interview with the castaways, we did have just a very short clip of this little six-year-old girl. She was 6 years at the time. She actually played Girl from Bird Box. People may remember a few years ago, it was a scary movie, but I had no idea that little actress, her name was Vivian Blair, was raised as a vegan. And she talks about her love for animals and how she likes vegetables. So to give us a little bit of a warm feeling going into Thanksgiving, we're going to listen to that next. And then we're going to hear about some important news about Paul Watson coming up before the show ends.
My eyes were covered in Bird Box, but I always look out for animals. That's why I'm a vegetarian. I've been a vegetarian since I was born. I've always loved animals so much, and I'd never think of doing anything to hurt them. I like fruit a lot, fruit and veggies. I like edamame and asparagus, green beans, and tofu rice bowl from Yuko Kitchen. I'm still working on liking spinach more. Cats are my favorite animals. Cats. I have three rescues. Laszlo is an orange tabby, the meowiest of all of them. Meow, meow, meow. I just want to say to everybody out there who's watching this, if you want to adopt an animal, you should do it. Treat them kind and wonderful. And I want to make the world a better place for animals.
We're joined by the stars of Gilligan's Island. We have with us tonight Russell Johnson. His book is called Here on Gilligan's Island, the professor's behind-the-scenes guide to everything you wanted to know about the island. Gilligan, Maynard, and Me by Bob Denver, who's on the wire tonight from Chicago, Illinois. And Marianne's Gilligan's Island Cookbook by Dawn Wells. What are some of the recipes we can look forward to in the Gilligan's?
That's a good question. It's good home cooking. I'm a really good cook. My mother's a phenomenal cook. Three generation of Wells family recipes. A lot of recipes from the cast. Russell's a good cook. A lot from him. Bob's a vegetarian. A lot from his family. Mm-hmm. I know there's about 8 or 10 of his. Mostly vegetables.
But you give them all new names.
Oh, I know, and I'm having the hardest time. My co-authors, Ken Beck and Jim Clark, did the Aunt Bee cookbook, and they've got these funny little names. S.S. Mm-hmm. Minostroni. But the recipes are authentic, and there are 13 coconut cream pie.
Hey guys, what's up and welcome back to Gretchen's Vegan Bakery. It's true, I've finally completed recipe number 4 in the Best Cream Pie Recipes series that I started last month. But for this coconut one though, I did use a can of full fat coconut milk in addition to the soy milk. In a medium sauce pot, combine both of those milks, the sugar and the cornstarch mixture. And this time I am adding literally a pinch of turmeric, like less than an eighth of a teaspoon. Turmeric adds a natural yellow tinge to custards. Get it to the stove and bring it to a boil, stirring constantly to avoid scorching the bottom. And once it comes up to a boil, remove it from the heat, add in the vegan butter, whisk it smooth, then the vanilla extract, and then goes the toasted coconut. Just remember to reserve a couple tablespoons of the toasted coconut for the topping of the finished pie. yeah, I bought the crust, but Midel has a vegan crust, and it happens to be gluten-free as well. So there's your time saver right there. But of course, you can make your own crust from your favorite sandwich cookie or graham crackers like I did in all of my previous cream pie recipes. So just pour that hot custard into the crust and refrigerate it until it is set. And I am actually topping it with the Lazy Butt brand, which is so delicious, coconut whip topping. It's really good. But if you have the energy and you want to make your own homemade recipe for vegan whipped cream, I do have several options on my blog, and all the clickable links are below this video in the box as usual. The remaining toasted coconut, and voila, you have yourself the most delicious, easiest, cheapest, veganest coconut cream pie you will ever try. All right, you guys, until next time, happy vegan baking. Bye for now.
And coming up next, a fascinating interview with the vegan hero, Captain Paul Watson, formerly of Greenpeace, formerly of Sea Shepherd, who is being held in very unfair charges in Greenland right now, which you're going to hear all the details of in this interview. This interview was conducted by Chad Copeland, and it comes from the Captain Paul Watson YouTube page, where you can find a lot more information.
You can also find out how to write to Paul in prison in Newark at the Captain Paul Watson Foundation website.
What Japan is doing is illegal. This boat has been designed to kill whales in the Southern Ocean or North Pacific. What's the point of international law if there is no enforcement? That is why we do what we do. As soon as I arrived here in Nook, they literally ripped me off the captain's chair and handcuffed me and marched me down. I've been here for 65 days now. I'm being held for something that happened 14 years ago. The court has refused to look at the evidence. Whales are the farmers of the ocean. They're providing the nutrients to the phytoplankton. That provides up to 70% of the oxygen in the air we breathe. Far more important than the trees. Since 1950, there's been a 40% diminishment in phytoplankton. If phytoplankton disappears from the ocean, we die. So I've done everything I can over the last 50 years to protect as many whales as possible. Think that there's a real possibility that we can actually break through and communicate with whales. Especially now we have AI.
From Nuuk, Greenland, I'm Chad Copeland, and I'm sitting today with Captain Paul Watson. Paul, thank you for joining me.
No, thank you.
Tell me what's going on. Why are we here?
Well, I've been here for 65 days now. I'm being held on an Interpol red notice that Japan had issued for something that happened 14 years ago. I'm not too concerned about being extradited because the evidence will show that not only was I not there when the so-called offense took place, but it's so minor. And even under Greenland Danish law, I mean, if I were to be charged for what they're charging me here, it'd be about a 1,500 kroner fine, about $600.
Wow.
So under these extradition things, you can't send somebody to a country if there's an equivalent offense in that particular country.
Okay.
It's also, there's a lot of political motivation here. The fact that we were exposing illegal Japanese whaling, the fact that it was condemned by the International Court of Justice, the International Whaling Commission, the Australian Federal Court. And so basically all we did was expose it with our cameras. So I'm really being here because of revenge for a television show, and Japan needs a scapegoat. All they have to do is look at the evidence, and they haven't looked at the evidence. The court has refused to look at the evidence.
And have you seen their evidence?
Well, what happened is when the last time I was in court, the judge said, okay, we can see the evidence. And then they showed the video clip in the Japanese. And then when my lawyer said, well, here's the counter from the other side, he wouldn't allow it. I think that there's another motivation here. It's not just Japan.
What is that?
Faroe Islands. We haven't broken any laws in the Faroe Islands, but this is way Denmark can get back at us. Faroese were the ones who contacted the Japanese and said, oh, well, he's going to be coming in Greenland. You should get him. They selectively put out this red notice to Denmark specifically. So when I came through Ireland, went through customs, no problem. I was Switzerland, no problem. But as soon as I arrived here in Nuuk, there is 15 Danish police officers here to meet me, and they're a pretty hostile bunch. They literally ripped me off the captain's chair and handcuffed me and marched me down. And you would think that I was charged with, like, killing somebody or injuring somebody, but none of that happened.
What are the charges?
Obstruction of business, trespassing, conspiracy to trespass. 2010, what happened was that Pete Bethune, who was not one of my crew members, he had his own boat called the Yachty Gill, but he was working with us, and he was a bit of a cowboy, trying to play chicken with these guys. I don't know what exactly he was doing, but the Shona Maru number two deliberately rammed him, and you can see this on video. I don't know if you've seen that or not.
I have, yes.
But he deliberately rammed the Shona Maru, cut this $2 million vessel in two, almost killed the people on board, injured the Animal Planet cameraman on board. I was 250 miles away from this point, but Bob Barker, my other ship, rescued them and took them back. And then later, Pete said he wanted to board the Shona Maru number two.
Okay.
Basically to give him a notice, say, you destroyed my ship. You know, I want you to pay for my
ship. Sure.
So he boarded the vessel. Now, I told him, and I'm on camera telling him this, I said, I think you should really stay and do media tour of New Zealand and Australia. He said, no, I've got to do this. And I said, well, okay, but I'm not part of it. And I'm not part of the planning. He used his own jet ski and his own crew member. He was never one of my crew members. And he went over to the Shona Maru, boarded it. He walked up, and you can see it on camera. He knocked on the door, and he presented the letter and got arrested for trespassing. Plus, he got arrested for destruction of property because he had to cut through the net to get onto the boat. Then they hauled him all the way back on the Shona Maru to Japan and tried him with trespassing. But then he made a deal. And the deal was this. The prosecutor said, if you say that Paul Watson ordered you to board this vessel, we'll give you a suspended sentence, which is what he did. 2 years later, he signed an affidavit and said that he lied in order to get that suspended sentence. And because of that, John Kerry, as Secretary of State, allowed me to return to the U.S. and said, this is bogus. There's nothing here. So I was able to come back to the United States after basically a year and a half in exile, almost 2 years in exile. But I had no problems after that. So this is all based on that false accusation that Pete Bethune made under duress. And that's all it is.
I'd like to look back a little bit, and I'd like to talk about the turning point for you from being a small child into activism and learning, you know, about marine wildlife and speaking for the whales. Can you go down that road?
I was raised in a East Coast Canadian fishing village called St. Andrews. When I was young, I was a member of a group called the Kindness Club, which was set up by the premier of New Brunswick's wife, Ida Fleming. So I was a member of that club, and at 17, I went to Vancouver. I joined the Norwegian Merchant Marine, and I was in the Swedish Merchant Marine, and then I was in the Canadian Coast Guard, and then I studied communications at Simon Fraser University. But in 1969, there was a demonstration on the border of British Columbia and Washington. It was against nuclear testing in Amchitka. It was by a group called the Don't Make a Wave Committee, which I became a member of.
Okay.
And we decided, well, what can we do about this nuclear testing up there? And the Don't Make a Wave Committee was set up by two groups, the Sierra Club, of which I was a member, and the Quakers. And the Quakers said, well, back in 1956, we sent a boat down to Bikini Atoll to protest it. And so we said, well, why don't we do the same thing? We'll send a boat up to Amchitka to protest it. Now, at one of the early meetings, somebody left the meeting and said, peace. Bill Darnell said, make it a Greenpeace. And Bob Hunter said, great name for the boat. So that was the Greenpeace. The boat came before the organization.
Wow.
They went up in October of 71. There were 13 crew members on board. They delayed the detonation.
Okay.
And then they came back, but they were still going to go ahead with it. So that was where the Greenpeace 2 came in, and I was a crew member on the Greenpeace 2. And that was a better boat. It was a converted minesweeper. We raced up to Amchitka, but now instead of delaying it, they blew it up a day ahead of time. So we were still a few hundred miles away from it. But what happened was that it got incredible publicity, and that was the last test in the Aleutians. So I think that we contributed to that happening. So in 1972, we changed the name of the Don't Make a Wave Committee to the Greenpeace Foundation. Actually got the name Foundation from Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy, but that's another story. But in 1974, Dr. Paul Spong came to us. He's a whale scientist. And he said, you know, we got to do something about the killing of whales by Japan, by Russia, and whatever. And I jumped on that right away. And Bob Hunter, too. And, well, what can we do? I said, well, you know, in the Coast Guard, where I was working at the time, we have these small inflatable boats. So why don't we just block the harpoons with our bodies, like do a Mahatma Gandhi. We were reading a lot of Mahatma Gandhi at the time. We thought this would be the way to do it. And so, yeah, so that's what we decided in 1974. So we raised money to get the boat, which we chartered this 85-foot halibut vessel called the Phyllis Cormac.
Okay.
Changed the name to the Greenpeace 5. And the project was called Project Ahab, or Ahab's Children.
Yes.
And that. And then, so May of 75, we set out from Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
Had an enormous crowd to see us off. And we had no idea where the Russian or Japanese whaling fleets were, but we're going to go out there and find them. Now, one of the strangest things that happened, and something that hasn't really been reported much, is how do we find these whaling fleets? The Russian whaling fleet was the one we could find. Why? Because we had a contact who worked for Alfonso Bell, I think it was congressman.
Okay.
And we got the Russian coordinates.
Wow.
For the Russian fleet. They're only operating a few miles off the coast of California before the 200-mile limit.
Ah, yes.
So we had a North Vancouver telephone book as our code, and we were getting coded message from Craig Van Note, who was the aide to the congressman, and I you better check with him on Jesus' name. I think he will. Everybody knows it, but
sure, yeah.
But anyway, so we headed. They're off the coast of California, so we headed down and we found the Soviet whaling fleet 65 miles off of Mendocino.
Okay, yes.
And that's when we decided, okay, now this is where we're going to put our Gandhian tactics into effect. So there I was with Bob Hunter in this small inflatable boat.
Mm-hmm.
Six incredible sperm whales fleeing for their life in front of us. And behind us, a Soviet harpoon vessel bearing down at us at 20 knots.
Mm-hmm.
And every time he tried to get a shot, I would maneuver the boat and block his harpoon. And this was great. Well, I looked at Bob and said, hey, we're actually doing it. And it worked for 20 minutes. And until the captain on the Soviet vessel came running down the catwalk. And he screamed into the ear of the harpooner, looked down at us, smiled, and brought his finger across his throat. And that's when I said, you know, I don't think Gandhi's going to work for us today. And a few moments later, there was this incredible explosion.
Mm.
And the harpoon flew over her head and slammed into the backside of a female in the pod. And she screamed. I didn't even know whales could scream. She screamed, rolled on her side, blood everywhere. And suddenly, the largest whale in that pod rose up and then dove and slapped the water with his tail and disappeared. Swam right underneath of us and threw himself straight at the bow of the Soviet vessel to protect his paw. But they were waiting for him with an unattached harpoon and pulled the trigger and hit the whale point right in the head and fell back. And he was rolling in agony on the surface. There's blood everywhere. And as he was rolling about on the surface, I caught his eye. He looked straight at me and then he dove again. And this time I saw a trail of bloody bubbles coming real fast towards us. And he came up and out of the water at an angle so that the next move would have come crashing down on us. And as his head, it was almost as in slow motion, as his head came up out of the water, and I looked into his eye, which was right there, so close I could see my own reflection in the eye of this whale. And as he rose up higher, I felt that this whale understood what we were trying to do.
Right.
Because I could see the effort he made to suddenly pull himself back. And instead of crashing down on us, he began to slide back into the sea. I saw his eye disappear beneath the surface and he died. Could have killed us.
Oh, yeah.
I personally am indebted to that whale for the fact that I am still alive because that whale could have killed us.
Wow.
And so what happened was that I'm sitting there in the middle of the Soviet fleet. The sun's going down 60 miles off of Mendocino. And I'm saying to myself, why are we doing this? Why are they killing these whales? They don't eat them. They kill them for oil, sperm oil, spermaceti oil. And one of the most prized uses was for the construction and maintenance of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And I said to myself, here we are killing this incredibly beautiful, socially complex, intelligent, sentient, self-aware being for the purpose of making a weapon for the mass extermination of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it just hit me. We're insane.
We are.
We're just totally crazy. And I said, I'm not going to. Everything I do for the rest of my life will be for that. And that's what I've done. So I've sort of got 50 years of my life because of that experience. I don't know why, but I feel indebted to that whale, and I feel that that's a service that I have to provide. So I've done everything I can. over the last 50 years to protect as many whales as possible. And I think we've made an incredible difference. When in 1974, Australia, Chile, Spain, South Korea, Peru, Brazil, all of these countries are killing whales. And now whaling is restricted to the territorial waters in Norway, Iceland, and Japan, and Iceland's pretty much out of it. But as of 2019, that was the end of pelagic whaling. There are no whales being killed in international waters. I mean, it's been an amazing victory when you think about it.
It is.
My concern is Japan wants to return to pelagic whaling, and that's why they built this new factory ship, the Kanji Maru, to go back to the Southern Ocean or to the North Pacific. And that's why we started Operation Kanji Maru. And I think that's one of the reasons that Japan wants to stop us now, is because of that.
What's unique about that new boat?
First of all, it makes no sense to build a boat like that for coastal whaling. This is a boat built for long-range whaling. It can carry an incredible amount, much more than the Nishan Maru, carry more fuel, and it's faster. Plus, it's also equipped with water cannons for protesters. But also, they put a top over the cleansing deck, so now you can't see it from the air like we used to film on that. So this boat has been designed to go kill whales in the Southern Ocean in the North Pacific. It certainly makes no sense to spend that kind of money to build a vessel like that for coastal whaling. So this is what their intention is. They'll deny it, but I don't see how they can explain why they got a vessel that long range, that big, that powerful for any other reason.
For the average person who might be at home watching an NFL show, why do whales matter?
My personal motivation is whales matter because they're whales. Right. You know, I think they have a right to live. I don't think we have a right to kill them. And, you know, I've read almost everything on the history of whales and whaling, and I think it's a barbaric and shameful history on our part for what we've done to them. But there's also the ecological importance of whales. Whales are part of the, basically, they're the farmers of the ocean. They're providing the nutrients to the phytoplankton. You know, where they're bringing up nutrients from the depths. Their feces spreads it across the surface like that. And, you know, since 1950, there's been a 40% diminishment in phytoplankton in the sea. The latest article on that was way back in 2010, so it's probably worse now, but that was in Scientific America. So a 40% diminishment of a group of plants, very small plants in the ocean, that provides up to 70% of the oxygen in the air we breathe and sequesters incredible amounts of CO2. If phytoplankton disappears from the ocean, we die. We do not live on this planet without phytoplankton. Far more important than the trees, you know, which provide the other 30%, the trees and the plants. But,
right.
You know, and why is phytoplankton being diminished? Because we're diminishing the number of whales and seabirds and fishes and everything in the sea that provide that nutrient base, that provide the nitrogen and the iron, the magnesium, all the elements that are required by phytoplankton. So really, we're cutting our own throats by killing whales on that. So that's the ecological reason that we should be protecting whales. But on the other hand, there also, I think, there's incredible potential to be able to communicate with another living thing on this planet. We know that they have incredibly developed brains. Certain parts of the brains are far more developed in various areas than ours, especially in the area of communications and that. And I think that we will be able to, especially now we have AI and all these things, and actually there has been some advances with AI and communicating with humpback whales off the coast of Alaska.
Okay.
I think that there's a real possibility that we can actually break through and communicate with whales. So much that we could learn on that. I don't know if we want to hear what they have to say about us, but you know, but I think that there's a lot to be gained by learning how to communicate with them.
Can you delve into that a little bit more? What do you know about bioacoustics with the whales? And there's been some studies recently where somebody thought that they learned what the whale hello is, and then they sent that out there.
That was that study of Alaska.
Yes.
Right. Back in 1974, Dr. Paul Spong, he was a cetologist, a New Zealand biologist, and he came to us and he said, you know, these are incredibly intelligent creatures, and I think that one day we'll be able to communicate with them. And Paul's ever since, he runs Orca Lab off of in the Johnstone Straits up in British Columbia, and has worked with orcas primarily. And he was the one who was most instrumental in getting Greenpeace involved with the protection of whales. And, you know, I've followed everything he's done over the years, plus, you know, other John Ford's work on accents and dialects of orcas and that, and other people, Sylvia Earle's work, everybody. There's so much work that's been done on the possibility of interspecies communication. So, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm not going to be one, the person to do that. But I'm certainly encouraging people who want to pursue that, because I think that it has a lot of potential.
As we were speaking about, whales are known for their intelligence and culture. What is whale culture?
Well, I think every species has a culture. You know, from bees onwards up, they all have a culture. But whales live in a world of, you know, they communicate with each other. I believe they have art. I believe that they think. I believe that they dream. I believe that they have a lot of social intercourse. I think we found that, you know, dolphins, for example, we've found that they actually identify each other by a name. Mm. So like John or Bob, you know, dolphins or whatever that is, that there's so much that we don't know about whales and dolphins and how they communicate. But overall, I believe that they all have a right to live on this planet without being barbarically slaughtered by us. So we really have no business doing that. The focus of our campaign when we left Ireland on the John Paul DeJoria was to focus global attention on continued illegal Japanese whaling operations. By arresting me here in Greenland, they've continued that campaign 1,000-fold. We got more coverage of what Japan's doing, plus adding what Denmark's doing in the Faroe Islands. So it's been an enormous success as a campaign. I sort of said, well, I just jumped off my ship, the John Paul DeJoria, and jumped on this ship called the Prison in order to carry on that message. I'm confident that Denmark will not extradite me to Japan, because that'll be a death sentence, and they know that. But I don't know how long it'll take for them to decide that. I think that the evidence is in my favor. All the facts are in my favor. They just have to look at it. But there seems to be a bit of a reluctance for the court to look at the facts, because there is a reluctance to make a decision. And also we have the political problem, because the Greenland court has to decide, the Danish court can't. If the Greenland court decides to extradite, then it goes to the Supreme Court in Denmark, and that could take who knows how long and everything. So it's a, you know, normally I can be quite patient. I only have one regret, as I got two little boys, and, you know, and just on Sunday, I'm allowed 10 minutes a week to speak with them. And on Sunday, I asked my 7-year-old, it's going to be his 8th birthday. I said, what do you want for your birthday? And he said, I just want you to come home. So that was sort of very hurtful. So that's the one thing that I really am concerned about. Other than that, I can be patient, whether or not. I mean, it isn't easy saving whales, you know. So I've been arrested numerous times. I've never been convicted of a crime, but I have been arrested, and I have been spent a lot of times in prison waiting for decisions. I've been sued and won. I wish I didn't have to do any of this, you know. I'd rather just sit back and write poetry and let an international environmental police force do all of this. That's all that's required. I mean, what's the point of having the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary if it can kill whales in the sanctuary?
That's right. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And also, why is it that Japan can destroy a $2 million vessel, no consequences? Why can they fire stun grenades, I guess, at Animal Planet cameramen and knock the cameras out of their hands, no consequences? How can they shoot me, no consequences? You know, after I got shot in 2007, I took the bullet from my Kevlar vest and I brought it to the Australian Federal Police, and I said, can you do an investigation on this? And their answer was, not our jurisdiction. I said, well, then how come when I come back from the Southern Ocean, at Japan's request, you look at my computers and run through the ship looking for evidence of wrongdoing? You're investigating their complaint, but you refuse to investigate my complaint. So why is this a one-sided sort of thing? Why is the law on the side of the criminals?
Yeah, why is it so hard to do the right thing?
Yeah, because you know, the problem is there's a lack of economic and political motivation to uphold international conservation law. In 2014, there was no whaling because the International Court of Justice was taken to court. 2015, 2016, they returned. So Sea Shepherd did Operation Relentless in 2015 and Operation Nemesis in 2016, 17. And that was under the leadership of Australia, Sea Shepherd Australia, and specifically Bob Brown and the Bob Brown Foundation. And I was not involved in it. Sea Shepherd USA was not involved in it. So that's how we got around that whole thing. And finally, we figured that it costs Japan so much money. We figured we cost them over $100 million. But most importantly, we saved 6,500 whales in the process.
Definitely.
So, but in the process, we humiliated Japan. We caused a great deal of shame to Japan, and that is the reason they're after me now. It's a pretty bogus charge. It's a minor charge. Certainly not an extraditable offense. But in Denmark, they found an ally because of the killing of pilot whales and dolphins.
Yeah, I'd like to see that end.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully it will. I'm quite confident that they won't extradite me. If they do, they'll be looking really bad. And it'll go before the European Human Rights Commission and everything. Japanese prisons are notorious. They're medieval. You go to Japan, you are interrogated every single day till you confess. You don't even get before a court until you confess. That's why they have a 99% conviction rate. A couple of my crew members of Protecting Dolphins were arrested, went through that whole process. Aaron Vermillen from the Netherlands was one of the few who actually won his case. He was in jail for a number of weeks, but he won his case because of a tape recorder of an accuser lying. We had him on tape. They couldn't get around that. This guy lied. Mm-hmm. And so that was his reason for being acquitted. But he did not confess through this whole thing.
Isn't it odd to be detained for such a period of time as you have?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I'm 65 days now. And they haven't even looked at the evidence. They refuse to look at the evidence. And so I think that in itself is a violation of my human rights, I think.
It is. And what's it like in here? I remember reading an article recently that you said that it's one of the best prisons you've been in. You see icebergs and whales going by every day.
I look out my prison window. I see the fjord and the mountains and the icebergs, and I've seen whales out there. I see Arctic foxes. I see ravens. And so wildlife-wise, and also everybody's fairly decent here. The prisoners are friendly. The guards are friendly. And it's also, you know, as far as when it comes to diet, you actually buy your own food, cook your own food, and you're you know, so being vegan or vegetarian, I mean, you can deal with that quite easily here, although there's a limited amount. But overall, it's not uncomfortable. And I could stay here for 2 years if that was the case, if it wasn't for my children.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So again, all of our wishes for the safe release of Captain Paul Watson, such a hero to us all. You are listening to the Vegan World Radio Show. And as we're coming up on the end, we want to wish everybody a happy family gathering. Please go vegan for Thanksgiving if you haven't already. And learn more about vegan food, how to help animals. And join us again next Monday night here on KPFT 90.1 in Houston. We always say there are a world of reasons to go vegan. A vegan world will bring us peace. And as Shirley used to say, there'll be a great celebration the day the last slaughterhouse closes down. We hope to see you there.
And whether you're with family or with friends or just with yourself or with your animal friends or whatever you're doing, we do wish y'all well out there.
This is Colleen from Howlin' the Blues, and here are a few music events for the week of December 2nd. On Wednesday, December 4th, Colby Cooper will be at Main Street Crossing, Micah Cheatham at Do-Si-Do Whiskey Bar, and Luke Rose at the Big Top. On Thursday, December 5th, Joe Stark will be opening for Mark Broussard at the Heights Theater. Keaton Kaufman will be at the Continental Club, Glenn Templeton at Main Street Crossing, and the Hot and Heavies and Opie Hendrix at the Big Top. On Friday, December 6th, Cassie Steven will be at Anderson Fair, Sun Bio at the Continental Club, Jeff Plankenhorn and Michael O'Connor at Do-Si-Do Whiskey Bar, Jordan Matthew